All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. No, I am not Jim Fossone. This is Dale Thronberry. But actually, none of us are here because we're off watching the Jets fly over at Thunder over Michigan. So it goes on for one more day. Make sure you get out there and do that if you can. I strongly encourage you to do so. But we do have a great show today. Actually, we have some pre-recorded elements. Jim is going to be talking with Joe Hickman and Frank Vera. Joe Hickman is the author of a book entitled The Convenient Terrorist, which is the inside story at the capture, torture, and detention of a gentleman named Abu Zubaydah. He was the first high-value target captured by the CIA and is still being held at Guantanamo Bay. So that's going to be our first interview. And the second interview is a gentleman named Frank Vera. And Frank is Frank's story is about the George Air Force Base in California, which is one of these big, giant Superfund sites that had over 100,000 military and family members that were exposed to severe toxic chemicals. And the health problems that they are developing and that they've been exposed to, and the delays by the DOD, the Air Force, and the VA are going to be discussed in this very compelling and fairly provocative interview with Jim in the second half of the program. So I encourage you to stick around and listen to our program today. I've got a couple of real quick announcements for you of upcoming events. Number one, of course, is that Thunder over Michigan is still going on today and again tomorrow, Labor Day, and I suggest you don't miss out on that. The next upcoming event that's really kind of fun is the annual pig roast for the BVA 310, Charles Kettle's post here in Ann Arbor. It's going to be next Sunday, September 10th, from noon until 4 p.m. It's at the VFW Post 423 on South Wagner Road in Ann Arbor, just off of Scio Church. We do this every year in an attempt to raise funds to care for our County Veterans Memorial, the parties for localized hospital veterans, Thanksgiving dinners for Dawn Farm residents, and many, many more. There will be live entertainment. We've got a Huey helicopter out there, and I have the privilege of telling people about the Huey out there. Other military vehicles, military merchandise sales, and all kinds of things like that. It's only $10 to get in. Ages 6 through 12 is only $5, and under 6 is free. So lots of food, lots of great opportunities. It says a note here, all motorcycle and other clubs are invited to make this a destination day. And as a member of the Washtenaw County VA Chapter 310, we always want to make sure that people know that never again shall a veteran be forgotten. So we encourage you to come out. That again, that's the annual pig roast, Sunday, September 10th, noon to 4 p.m. at the VFW post on South Wagner Road in Ann Arbor. I hope to see you there. Trying to do this chronologically, the next event that is coming up, is the Veterans Summit that's going to be held over in Livonia, Michigan at Madonna University, Kresge Hall. And this is the 8th annual Veterans Summit sponsored by the Canton Community Educational Fund. And you are going to be able to meet representatives from the VA, from the Ann Arbor and Detroit VA MCs, medical centers. There are also going to be all kinds of different experts there to talk about the update in property taxes, updates in benefits, healthcare updates, what's going on at the local VA. You're going to be able to learn more about the Freedom Center, the Fisher House. We'll have reps there, as well as Stiggy's Dogs. We did a great program about them a couple of years ago. So Sticky Dogs representatives will be there. Who should attend? Well, it should be veterans, caregivers especially. This is something really important. Caregivers should try to go to this. It is on Wednesday, September 13th from 9 to noon at Madonna University and Kresge Hall in Livonia, Michigan. They ask that you register, so please go to the website. That's CantonFoundation.org. That's CantonFoundation.org. Or you can call Beth Mead at 734-495-1200. It's Beth Mead at 734-495-1200. And it says that a box lunch will be provided at the end of the program. So mark your calendars Wednesday, September 13th, 2017, 9 to noon, Madonna University, Kresge Hall, Livonia, Michigan. And then finally here locally again is on Monday, September 18th, at Washtenaw Community College is going to be a Helping Our Veterans. Join us to another conversation about veterans benefits and services. And this will be Monday, September 18th from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Morris Lawrence Building. That's 4800 East Huron River Drive in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's on the campus of Washtenaw Community College. Our guests are going to include Congressman Debbie Dingell and Congressman Tim Walberg. Pretty cool. Our VA specialist, local benefits specialist Michael Smith, Colonel George Pettigrew, Brian Hayes, Judge Valvo. This is sponsored by the Veterans Community Action Team, the Washtenaw County Department of Veterans Affairs, and of course, Washtenaw Community College. So mark your calendar again. This is Monday, September 18th from 5:30 till 7:30 at the Morris Lawrence Building on the campus of Washtenaw Community College. Wow, a lot of great things coming up. If you've got more events that you want us to talk about, we'd be more than happy to do that for you. Just send an email to dale@veteransradio.net or go to our website.
Real quick reintroduction. This is Jim Falcone
talking with Frank Vera,
and
veteran advocate, and he's going to be talking about the toxic
to get all that
waste dump that they
out to our
George
public.
Air Force Base in
so
California.
So right now we're
going
to get to our program.
Of thousands of military and family members.
This week, as I mentioned,
so
stay tuned for this.
And
Joe Hickman,
who's going to be talking about Gitmo with our partner Jim Falcone. And also, our second story is going to be about the toxic waste dump out at George Air Force Base in California. And our guest is going to be Frank Vera. He's kind of an exposed veteran advocate. So stay tuned.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. Well, we're happy to have on Veterans Radio today Joseph Hickman. Joe, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we've got a couple of topics we want to talk about, but before we dive into it, let's learn a little bit about Joe Hickman. Where'd you grow up, and tell us about your military career.
Well, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. I joined the Marines when I was 18 years old. I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps. Then I got out of the military, had a break in service, and I missed the camaraderie you get from the military, and I missed just the strong friendships you make. So I went back in. This time I went in the Army for 3 years, and I got back out, and I felt like I did my duty, and I was done. But then 9/11 hit, and when 9/11 hit, I was a little older then. I was facing 38 years old, but I felt like I still had something to offer. So I went back in, this time to the National Guard, and I spent the next 13 years in National Guard, giving me 20 years of service, and I was happy to serve.
Well, I think I saw a note somewhere that you retired then in about 2009 with 20 years of service.
Yes.
And let's back up, though, because we often find it interesting. Why did you join up when you were 18 years old? Was it a family history of military service? Was there something pushing you in that direction or pulling you in that direction?
Mostly it was my dad pushing me. I was a kid that needed some self-discipline. I needed to grow up, and I wasn't growing up too quickly. And he thought the Marine Corps would be good for me. I was excited to join the Marine Corps. I thought it would be a good challenge, and boy was it.
Well, that's dad knew best, didn't he? If you wanted structure, he put you in the right group.
Yeah.
Now, had your father served, or was this something that he just said, look at you, son, you need the direction?
No, my father didn't serve. He was picked up on the lottery during the Vietnam War, but he was, at that point, he had two kids and married, and they put him at the back of the line, so he never went in.
Well, tell us a little bit about where your 20 years took you, what your MOS was, what areas you were assigned to, that sort of stuff, so our listeners can get a little more understanding and relate to you, Joe.
Yeah. My first 4 years, I was a field radio operator, pretty much known as a battery-operated grunt. I carried a radio on my back and was with 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. And my break in service, I guess that's important to mention, too. In my breaks of service, I worked as both a private investigator and a prison guard in Baltimore. And when I went in the Army, I was 11 Bravo. I was infantry for the Army and the National Guard as well.
Well, that civilian service led to some interesting experience with overseas assignments, and we'll talk about those a little bit later on. Let's turn now to the topic that you've also ridden on a couple of times, and we're talking to Joe Hickman, author of Murder at Camp Delta, about Gitmo, and also just out a new book called The Convenient Terrorist. Joe, let's start there. Tell us what The Convenient Terrorist is about.
The Convenient Terrorist is about a detainee that's held in Guantanamo Bay named Abu Zubaydah. He was the first high-value detainee that was captured in the global war on terror, and he was the first one that was exposed to our government's enhanced interrogation techniques by the CIA.
What's interesting about this book, and I can recommend it to all of our listeners, is sort of the fumbling and bumbling that goes on that we kind of all suspect, but you went out and documented it about, hey, did we even get the right guy? So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, Abu Zubaydah is the one that's held in Guantanamo. I'm going to say this up front. He's not a good guy. He's did some stuff. He was a logistical person for a warlord in Afghanistan, a very famous warlord in Afghanistan. But he ran jihadi training camps. He was not a good guy. But on the same token, he was not Al Qaeda, like the government claims he was. He was never Al Qaeda. He was never the third man in Al Qaeda. He was never a lot of things that they said about him was wrong. And I wrote the book with a CIA agent that actually captured Abu Zubaydah. He captured him, and in 2007, I was in Guantanamo when Abu Zubaydah, or 2006 rather, I was in Guantanamo when Abu Zubaydah arrived there. So we really wanted to set the record straight on who this person really was.
And there's also this handoff between the FBI and the CIA and DOD. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, it was there. His story is so complex that Zubaydah, once he was captured, he was interrogated by the FBI. CIA abruptly stopped those interrogations because he was in a secret base overseas, and they started their own interrogation program, hence the enhanced interrogation techniques. At the same time, right around just before they captured Abu Zubaydah, a lot of people don't realize they captured another Abu Zubaydah in the United States. This Abu Zubaydah was a pilot. He lived within a mile from some of the 9/11 hijackers. He bought a ranch in Montana for $650,000 in traveler's checks. He was studying explosives and figuring out how to blow up the Fort Peck Dam in Montana, which would have destroyed a big portion of the Midwest. He was arrested shortly after 9/11 and indicted under the FBI's 9/11 investigation called the Pentbomb investigation. But and a lot of his biography actually fit the biography of the Abu Zubaydah they were looking for in Pakistan, and who they captured and who is now in Guantanamo. But the information flowing in and the intelligence information flowing in at the time of 2001 was so bad, they never put the two together.
When you read this the way you and your co-author wrote it, you know, the reader ends up being like shocked at the degree of incompetency that permeates this whole area.
It was shocking, and John Kerouac was right in the middle of these huge intelligence lapses, and he can personally report how bad it was.
So part of this story is about this terrorist, Abu Zubaydah, who's captured in, is it 2002 when he gets captured?
March of 2002, yes.
Okay. And now we're in 2017, and he's still sitting at Guantanamo Bay, and he has been through all kinds of interrogation, including enhanced interrogation. So what information has the government gotten out of him that's at least, you know, non-classified that you can talk about?
They have that he was a logistical expert for a jihadi training camp, which means he would forge documents for people coming in to do jihadi training. And he would forge documents and for people, travel documents. That's really that's their strongest case against the guy. As I said, we've learned he wasn't Al-Qaeda, but what the government won't tell you also is a lot of these people that were training in jihad were training to fight the former communist regime that was in place in Afghanistan.
So why did you and John, I'm going to get his name wrong, Kirkow? Kerouac, why did you write this book? What message were you trying to get to the reader?
Well, we wrote the book we wanted to write a definitive book on this guy. He was claimed to be one of the masterminds of 9/11 at one time, and it was just completely not true. And we just wanted to set the record straight on who he was. And like I said, he wasn't a good guy, but he wasn't nearly what the government said he was.
And it's, you know, our veteran radio listeners, you have to understand that this is being written by, you know, Joe, you put 20 years into military service. Your co-author was a CIA agent 4 years. I mean, you don't have an axe to grind here with the country. You're trying to tell the story as you know it.
Yes. He is, the truth needs to come out. And a lot of times we have some wool over our eyes and we just, as American soldiers, we need to know what we're fighting and what we're fighting against. And anything that's false is going to hinder how we are on the battlefield.
Well, let me ask, currently, is there any plan to either try or release, Abu Zubaydah, who's been sitting in Guantanamo for over a decade?
No. He has never been charged with a crime, and he is not afforded due process at all.
And you're currently a senior research fellow at Seton Hall Law School Center for Policy and Research in New Jersey. Tell us what their involvement has been in sort of trying to get an understanding of what's going on at Guantanamo.
Well, they have a series of reports called the Guantanamo reports. Some I participated in. They are many of them are just trying to show the legal aspect and the legal issues that are up against these detainees or up against the government and how hard it is to actually prosecute them. And we also studied recidivism rates. I don't feel the government's recidivism rates were all that accurate when they were reporting it.
In terms of when we release these guys back to whatever country we send them to, do they find themselves back in prosecuting the war on terror?
Yeah, the government's For example, the government on one of the recidivism, they said these three former detainees went back to the battlefield. After I researched what they meant by back to the battlefield, they made a movie about their experience in being held in Afghanistan in Guantanamo. It was a cheap B-rated or even C-rated movie they made, and it appeared in mostly Great Britain, but it was that was considered going back to the battlefield. And I didn't feel like that was someone returning to the battlefield.
Sure. So your Guantanamo Bay experience as I think you went there with the National Guard.
Yes.
Is that also a little bit of what has shaped your view of what's gone on or should be going on at Camp Delta?
Yes. I mean, I believe that this treatment in Guantanamo has gotten a lot better since 2006 and 2007. But when I was there, I didn't like, I worked in the prison system and, you know, in the civilian world. And I just thought the standards were not that good at all. They were below standards.
So you also wrote, and I want to touch on it a little bit, a book called Murder at Camp Delta. Tell us a little bit about that book that you've written.
Well, I wrote about June 9, 2006, when I was on duty. Three detainees were taken out of Camp Delta and moved to a CIA black site. And several hours later, they returned, and the three detainees were dead. And I wrote the book to put out the facts as I knew them on what I witnessed down there that night, what other soldiers witnessed down there that night. And I wanted the reader to come to a conclusion of what they thought happened that night. I thought that something very fishy happened. Me and nine other soldiers went to the Justice Department and told them, hey, you know, the official story that came out that these men committed suicide in their cells, it just doesn't match up with what we saw. And we went and reported, like I said, to the Justice Department. And after a 10-month investigation, they came back and said we had the gist of the information correct, but they couldn't tell us why they weren't going to do anything with it. And come to find out, the reason was it was a CIA black site where these men were transported, and they were not supposed to have a black site there.
Well, and I think this is one of these stories that's important to get out, because we often, you know, we just get the highlights of the news, and we might wonder, I wonder if that's the whole story. What am I not being told? And it seems that part of what your mission has been in both Murder at Camp Delta and The Convenient Terrorist, which is published by Hot Books and Skyhorse Publishing, is to kind of get the rest of the story out for the reader.
Yeah, I want them to hear both sides, for that story, the burn pits, I just wanted, that's a back page story, and it should be front page, the burn pits. It's 100,000 veterans that are sick and dying, and it's disgusting that we want to report on a Russia-Trump deal when we have this going on with our veterans.
Well, you really have added to the information that's available to the general public, and I think that's a great thing to do. Joe Hickman, what else are you working on? What's in the? Is there anything else in the hopper we ought to know about?
Just some things in the early stages. I'm not ready to talk about them yet, but I am writing for Newsweek now. So I'm contributing there. You can keep up with me there. Or you can keep up with my stuff on Twitter at Joseph Hickman Zero.
Well, and you've really have elevated to this national commentator and author on these types of subjects. We really appreciate you taking some time here on Veterans Radio to inform our listeners about these important subjects, and we look forward to having you back when you bust the next story loose.
Thank you so much. I'm real happy to be here. I'll come back anytime.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Thanks for listening to Veterans Radio. We're going to be right back after the news, and so stay tuned. A real quick reintroduction. This is Jim Falsone talking with Frank Vera. Frank is an exposed veteran advocate, and he's going to be talking about the toxic waste dump at the George Air Force Base in California, which is affecting hundreds of thousands of military and family members. So stay tuned for this, and until then, I will see you next week.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Falsone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today an Air Force veteran, Frank Vera, who's involved with the George Air Force Base in some of the toxic base issues. Frank, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim, for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, this is an important issue, and it's one on Veterans Radio we're doing a little extra work on, which is, you know, the environmental condition at former military bases. But before we get too deep into that, let me give a little background to our listeners here. George Air Force Base is in Southern California. It has been operating as a Air Force Base since around in 1941 when it was the Army Corps Advanced Flying School, and it closed. It changed its name once or twice. It became Victoryville Army Airfield in the 1943 area, and became George Air Force Base in 1950 and was decommissioned officially in 1992. Frank, when were you at George Air Force Base?
I was stationed at George in January 73 and discharged from George May 6, 74.
And I notice a number of people in your group that are working on this issue. They all kind of either passed through or were stationed at George during a lot of the 70s and into the 80s period. Your co-administrator, I think, on one of the sites is Lisa McCree, and it seemed like she was maybe stationed there as a civilian.
Well, her dad was stationed there. She was a child at George. And one of the things that people need to remember is George is one of 141 Superfund sites, DOD Superfund sites in the United States. There are an additional at least 12 more, possibly more, that weren't listed as Superfund sites because of political reasons. These Superfund sites are the most contaminated parcels, or some of the most contaminated parcels of land in the country, if not the world.
And the timing on this is helps begin to tell the story, listeners. George Air Force Base was proposed for a Superfund site in 1989. It made the National Priority List, which is that Superfund list, the next year in 1990. And if you'll remember, we told you it was finally decommissioned in 1992. So you maybe could draw some lines between knowing what was going on environmentally at the base and slating it for closure.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up because the Air Force had just spent millions of dollars. They built a brand new hospital, all brand new dorms. They rebuilt the infrastructure, and it wasn't slated for closure. There were three officers in a news article that state that the Air Force intentionally provided false information that led to the recommendation to close George Air Force Base in California. There's a link to the website. It's, the news article. Ex-officers, Air Force lied about the range. But I do find it very suspect that given the amount of miscarriages and stillbirths and childhood cancers that we had at George, the multitude of environmental issues, burn pits, open-air incinerator, VOCs in the groundwater and soil, extremely high levels of organochlorine pesticides in the housing, and the radioactive waste sites.
One of the things that I think non-veterans might be surprised at on these large bases, you have everything. You have landfills, you have incinerators, you have open pit burning that went on, or burn pits. We've done a whole series on burn pits over in Iraq and Afghanistan recently. The use of fire retardant foam, both in practice, training, and in real emergencies, the chemicals associated with that, the jet fuel that gets leaked or haphazardly spilt over the years, causing groundwater contamination, and specifically something called trichloroethylene, or TCE, which in some parts of the world it would just be viewed as a degreaser cleaner on metal parts. But here in the United States, we know it's a cancer-causing solvent that's at George. It's contaminated two aquifers, I believe, and maybe is threatening a third in the Mojave River. So there's a whole lot of pollution going on there, isn't there, Frank?
Yes, there is. I've been told by several people within the DOD that George Air Force Base is far more polluted than Camp Lejeune. They say it's one of the worst contaminated sites in the country. I mean, worst contaminated military bases in the country because of the nature and extent of the contamination and the radioactive contamination at the base.
So Frank, bring us up to speed. What is, whether it's DOD or EPA or just in general the federal government, what are they doing to clean up the problems today that exist at George Air Force Base?
Well, the Air Force has spent a little over $120 million on the cleanup out at George, but most of that money was spent generating reams of reports. Like any attorney knows that if you go up against a large firm, the smaller firm gets papered to death. The regulators, whether they be the federal EPA, the state EPA, or the lead Lahontan Water Agency, they have one, maybe two people staffed to oversight George and sometimes another base as well. The Air Force has generated reams of documents with conflicting information, and they've just papered over the problem. They have done a little bit of environmental work, but most of it has been extremely sloppy. And if you're not truthful and honest, if there's no transparency, there can't be a cleanup because you have to acknowledge the true nature and extent of the contamination to address it. And the Air Force's whole goal seems to be just to sweep it under the carpet, and now they're proposing natural attenuation, which means that they're just going to walk away from the base and let the contaminants degrade over time. And
well, let me back up though. That I don't want this to turn into an environmental debate that's the wrong cleanup method. I think that'd be an easy debate to have. But let me back up. How many folks, do you have an estimate of how many living veterans have passed through, been stationed at the George Air Force Base during the operation?
Well, The Air Force hasn't really released any numbers on it, but looking at the base population and multiplying by the number of years that the base was open, I estimate at least 100,000 men, women, and children lived on the base and in close proximity to the base. Most people, when they think of a military base, they think it's adults living there, but they forget that a lot of these adults have families. So you have, you know, spouses, developing fetuses, toddlers, young children, living, going to school on the base, playing on the base. And it just seems that the DOD in general was rather irresponsible in failing to address the contamination when they knew or suspected a problem existed.
Well, let me approach this another way, because I want to give our readers some context. They're probably familiar with Camp Lejeune and the contamination there, and that finally Congress is making DOD and VA do something about it. Do you suspect that more people lived and worked and were exposed at George Air Force Base than were exposed at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina?
No, Camp Lejeune was a much larger base, but yeah, the estimates that I've heard, there's 3 million people who were exposed in and around Camp Lejeune. George, I figure there's a little over 100,000 people.
Okay, that gives us some perspective.
Yes, sir.
And of those folks, is DOD or VA doing anything to inform them or compensate them or provide health monitoring to the people who were exposed at George?
No, the Air Force has not been responsive. I've written them. I've asked them. I was on the Restoration Advisory Board for George for several years. I begged them to notify people of their potential exposure. Their attitude was it would be too costly. And the Air Force has been actively, it appears, the Air Force has not only not notified the people that were there, but when we, the injured, try to file for a Social Security disability claim or a VA claim, we need our medical records. It took me decades to get my medical records out of the National Personnel Record Center. I had to hire a law firm, pay them $6,500 to find out that the Air Force is the legal owner of the records. The National Personnel Record Center is a physical custodian. The National Personnel Record Center has to get permission from the Air Force to release the records, and the Air Force was blocking the release of my records. We have a Facebook page, and I think it's about 20 people that have reported that they cannot get their records.
So is this, does the NPRC tell you the records aren't available, or that they're available and we can't send them to you?
No, that's the problem. For decades, I filed, you know, Privacy Act request. I went to my congressman. I had my service officer. I went down to the regional office, filled out the form, and asked that the National Personnel Record Center release all my records. They repeatedly came back and said, well, we released your records to the VA regional office. I filed a FOIA under Freedom of Information Act, / Privacy Act. What they should have done and what they were required to do is release all my files. If the records were to be withheld, they were required to redact them, give me the reason why the records are being withheld, give me my appellate rights, but they didn't do that. They just constantly lied. I filed an IG complaint with the National Personnel Record Center saying that they had not released my entire file. They responded by getting my entire C file from Los Angeles and burning it to disk and sending it to me. it was very nice of them. Better quality copies than I'd ever received. A few pages that I had not seen before. But again, they didn't release my records from the National Personnel Records Center. And it's just, it's inexcusable. It doesn't make sense.
Do you think Frank, they were hiding yours and other veterans who were stationed at George Air Force Base because they didn't want those medical records out?
I believe so. Any information regarding the military special weapon program, they're highly classified. Early generation nukes required a lot of field maintenance. They assembled them and maintained them. It generated a lot of radioactive waste. Out at George, they had open air atmospheric testing washdowns. So planes, aircraft left George, went to the Nevada test site, flew through the cloud, the atomic cloud after the blast, or flew in close proximity to it, taking photographs, came back to George, were decontaminated. That generated a lot of radioactive waste. It took years of FOIA requests to get records released about that. I think all the problems with the secrecy out at George begins and ends with the special weapons program.
And we should mention, I skipped over this at the front after saying I was going to talk to you about this. Why don't you tell us a little bit specifically about what you did when you were in the Air Force and stationed at George as a weapons mechanic?
All right. I entered the military when I was, you know, young during Vietnam. I had gone to a naval academy. Admiral Farragut Naval Academy. I wanted to get my junior ROTC out of the way. I wanted to go into the military. I wanted to go have the military pay for law school. I wanted to be a JAG for the military. And eventually, after my stint with them, go be an analyst with the FBI or CIA. That didn't happen. I ended up going into the military despite promising to send me to either the academy or allow me to go on reserve status and go into ROTC at a college to get my law degree. They said they had a greater need for me in weapons school. So I had an EBI background investigation, went to tech school at Lowry Field, Black Shack for weapons systems, was new qualified. Stationed out at George, I worked in the gun shop on the nose guns out of an F4E. And they had dropped the gun system on me, was crushed, put me on duty restriction, had me washing parts in hot trichloroethylene with no safety equipment. A couple of months later, was doing a little better. One of the people out of the gun shop out at George was killed in Vietnam, was moping, and just got on the dirt bike and rode out to the motocross track, opened a barrel. Granted, it was stupid to open the barrel, but I was on an awful lot of painkillers and muscle tranquilizers and been working with TCE, so my judgment wasn't the best. Opened a barrel, dug down into it, and was hospitalized later on that day. My lungs started burning, tried to make it back to the barracks, ended up in the middle of the road having convulsions, tremors, seizures. A man in a powder blue Dodge pickup truck, and a man and his son picked me up, put me in the back of the truck, took me to the hospital. They pumped my stomach, irrigated it, pumped it again. They had thought I had taken too many painkillers or something. 4 days later, I wasn't in the shop. Shop sent out somebody to find out what I was doing. They took me right to the hospital because I was in really, really, really bad shape. Went from 190 pounds down to 134 with blood coming out of everywhere.
So as you can see, those medical records you were searching for, because you had all that, you know, hospitalization and treatment and during time of service, those medical records were critical to ultimately being able to establish your disability claims. And that's why when they told you they don't exist, you're going, I know they existed. I was there.
Right.
You know, I mean,
well, when they dropped the gun system on me, it 1,500 pounds is a lot. It knocked me out, dislocated my right shoulder, broke my sternum, cracked three or four ribs on the side, right side, crushed the vertebrae in the spine, cracked my SI joint loose on both sides. I spent quite a bit of time in the hospital. You know, they didn't even allow me to get my claim straight for the back injury.
Well, let me move on to one other quick thing before we run out of time, because it's a story that's told on your website, which we'll talk about in a minute, but it's Terry Crooks' story about how she was assigned to George Air Force Base in 1980 through early 1982, and her challenges to get her VA benefits approved, and her exposure to chlordane and other organochlorine pesticides that were used actually in base housing, in the dorms and the barracks. And we can all visualize them doing it. We've been there when they've done this. They walk through and spray everything down with something. At the time, we're too young and dumb to know what the something is, but to kill all the bugs, and we're just glad the bugs are gone. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, seriously, we are. Can you tell us a little bit about Terry?
Yes. Terry had contacted me. Let me back up a little bit. I had all these ladies contacting me, telling me they were infertile. And about the eighth phone call, I asked the lady, what do you mean you're infertile? And she goes, well, I have kids and I can't carry them to full term. And I go, well, that's not infertile. Something's happening. I couldn't figure out what it was because I was mainly focusing on the radiation out at George. I contacted one of the oversight agencies, and they said, you really need to look at this organochlorine pesticide issue at the housing. So I started doing some looking at it, and I was not up to speed. There's thousands of pages of documents on this thing. And so the person sent me documents, told them didn't get it. They narrowed it down, and then finally I caught on. So I started building a page for the organochlorine pesticides out at George. Sorry. And then Terry saw the page and contacted me and said she was working on her VA CMP claim. She said she had, you know, all these issues, these medical issues. What do I think is a problem? I told her, well, I really don't know, but the only thing we have real solid documentation on is this organochlorine pesticides. So we put together, we talked over about 3, maybe 4 months. She'd let me know what she's doing, ask for documents, I'd send them to her. She ended up winning. She set a precedent for pesticide exposure out at George. I thought it was a really big deal. I sent it off to everybody. I sent it off to all the news organizations, and no one was interested.
Yeah.
You know, I reminded them that these organochlorine pesticides were used at every single military base. The military doesn't do anything without a tech order and a work order. These directives come down from DOD to the various branches, and they apply them like they say they were supposed to, you know, these pesticides are supposed to be applied. And so she ended up winning her claim.
She had both issues with breast cancer and with ultimately a hysterectomy because she couldn't bring children to term or a fetus to term.
Yes.
So I wanted to bring that in. We're just about out of time, but I wanted to bring it up because it for our listeners to understand, and we're talking to Frank Vera, who's an activist on these specifically at George Air Force Base, but on these a veteran who's involved with these toxic space issues, it's such a wide variety of chemicals. We're talking about things from nuclear to solvents like TCE to pesticides like these organochlorine pesticides. And you know, there's discussions on PCBs on it being used at the site. The whole thing, it's really challenging for the veteran to sort it out, isn't it, Frank?
It is. The amount of data that's available is overwhelming. And the clincher for Terry was the Air Force had leased the housing units to Victorville, the city of Victorville. City of Victorville subleased it to the Marines to do urban warfare training. The Air Force caught wind of it, and they were upset that Victorville was allowing these people to train there for a couple hours a day for, you know, a couple weeks. They sent the Victorville a letter saying, you know, you can't train them there. The amount of pesticides that were found in the housing could be hazardous, or if you inhale them, dermal ingestion. And so the Air Force notified Victorville, the recipient, but they refused to acknowledge what they did to us who had to live in the housing for years.
So by hard work and digging through all the documents, you found something that was an admission by the Air Force that acknowledged that the levels were hazardous to human health. Well, good job for Terry. Good job for everybody working on that issue. But it is unfortunate you have to work so hard. Let's wrap up here, Frank. Tell folks how they can follow some things you're doing on the web or on social media. Give us a rundown.
All right. So I have a website, georgeafb.info. It has just about everything that we have gathered so far in a fairly easy to understand format. There's contact information at the bottom left-hand corner of each page. We also have two Facebook pages, an open Facebook page, and then one for the people that were stationed at Georgia that were injured. And we do have an awful lot of injured people. The people who were harmed the most were the women and young children that lived at George, especially the young girls. Because these organochlorine pesticides are persistent, they don't break down over time. Well, they don't easily break down. They bioaccumulate. They're stored in the fat. When a woman gets pregnant, the body starts cannibalizing the fat stores, releases these organochlorine pesticides. They cross the placental barrier and do quite a bit of damage to have done quite a bit of damage to some of these children.
So let me remind our listeners that, and you can tell Frank's passionate on this, and we could talk for an hour, but you might listen for the hour. So I want to bring you back to. I want to thank Frank Vera for being my guest today on Veterans Radio, and I want to direct people to georgeafb.info for more information. You certainly can contact him there and participate both with knowledge that you have and additional information that you may need. And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.